Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
Hello, Buzzkillers. It's the old professor here. We're having a slight departure in sort of theme for this week. And that's all because our episode on the atomic bomb has had tremendous response. You remember it from last week. Professor Philip Nash was here to bust myths about the building of the bomb, the planning of the bomb, the deployment of the bomb. Well, buzzkillers from all around the world have been emailing us, they've been Facebooking, they've been tweeting like crazy for the past week. We've heard from veterans, veterans' families, scientists, other historians, and on and on and on. They've enlightened us with their stories and pointed us towards great other topics about the bomb and World War II in general. Researchers at the Buzzkill Institute, they've been beavering away, following up on these leads that you've sent. Thank you very, very much. And that's what I want to talk about today. We're not going to bust many myths, although there are a few of those we'll get to on the way. Rather, I'm going to tell you a straight history story. But it's one that also, I think, shows the value of diligence in historical research and the importance of righting wrongs from the past. Of the many, many messages you've sent, one topic kept coming up, and that was the USS Indianapolis. Now, many of you probably remember the story was told by Quint, the salty shark hunter, in the 1975 movie Jaws. It's one of the most famous monologues in Hollywood history, and some Jaws fanatics, not me, but some of them, can recite it word for word. You remember what happened. While drinking on the shark boat at night, Quint opens up to his shipmates, tells them of his brutal World War II experiences. He'd been on the Indianapolis, which was sunk after delivering atomic bomb parts to the island of Tinian, which we talked about last week, the island. According to Quint's story, the Indianapolis sailors were attacked and killed by sharks while they were waiting in the water to be rescued. It's a horrific tale and a tremendous dramatic performance by Robert Shaw as Quint. I asked Institute researchers to look into the history of the Indianapolis because movies usually mangle history. Now, it turns out that Hollywood only got the shark story wrong, really in terms of degree. In fact, the real history of the Indianapolis is much more dramatic and shocking than I knew. And you'll soon learn why I had to lock myself in the men's room at the Institute so no one would see me crying my eyes out. The USS Indianapolis was a World War II cruiser that had seen heavy action in the New Guinea campaign of early 1942, battles near Alaska in 1943, the Battle of the Philippines in 1944, and the Battle of Iwo Jima and the shelling of Okinawa in early 1945. Now, after having her battle damage repaired in San Francisco in July 1945, the Indianapolis was dispatched with enriched uranium and other parts for the Hiroshima bomb in her hold. They sailed for the island of Tinian, as you know, one of the bases for the bombings of Japan. The Indianapolis was not, quote, delivering the bomb, as Quint says in his story, only parts for it. The bomb was actually assembled on Tinian, and again, that's another amazing story that we'd like to tell you about later on. Mission completed, they left Tinian on the 27th of July, 1945. Just after midnight on the 30th of July, a Japanese submarine fired two torpedoes into the Indianapolis, causing massive damage, and the ship started to sink. Quint says, our bomb mission had been so secret that no distress signal had been sent. But that's not true. The true story is worse. Three distress signals were sent that night. None of the naval stations who received the signals responded, however. One of the station commanders thought the signal was a Japanese trap. Another one had ordered his men not to wake him during the night, and the third station commander was drunk. The Indianapolis listed and settled towards her bow, that means kind of, if you will, face first, and then sank quickly 12 minutes after being torpedoed. It went down faster than the time it takes you to listen to this podcast. Roughly 300 of the crew went down with her, and 880 were set adrift and with almost no lifeboats. The ship just went down too quickly. Many of the surviving sailors were left without even life jackets. Now, these 880 sailors were in the water for 4 days, but they began dying almost immediately. The Quint monologue tells us that they were killed wholesale by the sharks, but most of them actually died of injuries from the torpedo attack, from starvation, from thirst, from hypothermia. dehydration, something horrific called desquamation, which is apparently a severe peeling of the skin very deep, right, that it leaves your body just totally exposed to the elements and you die. And they were killed by their shipmates in moments of delirium and in moments of hallucination. The sharks killed many, but mostly they fed off the bodies of sailors who had already died from other things. Still, it's generally considered by experts to be the worst shark attack in human history, and it's still the worst loss of life in a single incident in the history of the United States Navy. Of the 880 soldiers who were set adrift, 483 died. Only 317 of the original 1,192 of the crew were rescued. The Indianapolis survivors were eventually spotted by an aerial patrol, and a massive Navy rescue operation picked them up. The rescue is its own harrowing and amazing story, but we'll have to save that for another day. Now, there's no doubt that the story of the Indianapolis was at least as tragic and awful as Quint made it sound. But I'm going to take you down a dark, dark road for the next few minutes, buzzkillers. Despite being wounded during the torpedo attacks, Charles McVeigh, the captain of the Indianapolis, survived the sinking and the days floating in the ocean. After being rescued, he was brought to Guam, which was a big naval base, for an investigation. That didn't go well, and Captain McVeigh was eventually court-martialed back in Washington, D.C. This was November 1945. Specifically, the charge of failing to zigzag in dangerous waters was very damaging to his case, even though McVeigh's orders were to zigzag at his discretion, depending on the weather and depending on the visibility, which was not great that night. McVeigh was found guilty in a humiliating and controversial trial. It was the only time a captain had been court-martialed with the loss of his ship due to enemy action in wartime, despite the bulk of evidence, frankly, that showed he was innocent. The head of the Navy, Admiral Chester Nimitz, remitted McVeigh's conviction in early 1946 and restored him to active duty, but technically the verdict of the court-martial stood. McVeigh served in the Navy until 1949 and reached the rank of Rear Admiral before he retired. But this back and forth blaming and clearing of McKay was only made worse by the fact that he had long been receiving hate mail from some of the parents of the Indianapolis dead. "Merry Christmas," read one card. "Our family's holiday would be a lot merrier if you hadn't killed my son." Imagine that. McVeigh never got over feelings of guilt for the tragedy. He spent his retirement being tormented by memories of the Indianapolis, and he fell into a deep depression. Captain McVeigh shot himself with his Navy-issued revolver in 1968, clutching a toy sailor that his father, a Navy admiral during World War I, had given him decades before. McVeigh's family, other Navy historians, and surviving Indianapolis sailors tried throughout the 70s and the 80s to have his name completely cleared by the Navy, but no one seemed to want to listen to a complicated story. You know how we are about complication, buzzkillers. It's a very important fact of history, and you have to face it. This apparent injustice continued until the late 1990s, when a young Florida boy sat down to watch Jaws with his father. Hunter Scott was so intrigued by Quint's retelling of the Indianapolis story that, encouraged by his parents, he looked into the history of the sinking and entered a project on the topic in his school's History Day competition back in 1997. Along the way, he read very, very widely on the subject, which included original source material that had not been seen since 1945. Scott also interviewed nearly 150 Indianapolis survivors, and he came to the conclusion that Captain McVeigh had been wrongly convicted. Along with members of the Indianapolis Survivors Organization, Scott appeared before a congressional committee in early 1998 to make the case for a reversal of McVeigh's conviction. Now, I've read the transcript of his testimony, buzzkillers. His evidence was detailed, and he presented it in a serious and convincing manner. He was also 12 years old. 12. In addition to the testimony given by the Indianapolis survivors, Scott's work convinced Congress to pass a resolution exonerating Captain McVeigh of any responsibility for the Indianapolis tragedy. President Clinton signed it in October of the year 2000. If nothing else, buzzkillers, this part of the story should convince you that historical research should never stop. There's almost always new evidence to uncover. There's old evidence to reevaluate. But there's one final thing about this whole Indianapolis story that really, really floored me. Lieutenant Hunter Scott is now an aviator in the United States Navy. Now, not that I'm stalking him for an appearance on the show or anything, but I did an internet search. Among a few other things, I found his LinkedIn page. Now, LinkedIn, as you know, Buzzkillers, is the popular business and career networking site. Now, while most LinkedIn pages trumpet even the most minor personal accomplishments, Lieutenant Scott's page is an absolute model of directness and modesty. No mention of the great work he did on Captain McVeigh in the Indianapolis. Just the very basics of his college life and Navy career. It makes all boasters and self-promoters like yours truly look like real jerks. And if you know a better true story than that one, Buzzkillers, by God, I'd love to hear it. Talk to you next week.
This is Aunt Ginger from Professor Buzzkill, and you're listening to the Epicast Network.